Chris, this is where we get a brand new term, intrusion masquerading. That's something you don't see. Us old folks would call that a red herring, but intrusion masquerading here. Imagine this, like dropping all the breadcrumbs to pretend that you've launched a ransomware attack and just spin up all the resources and all the things and all sorts of crazy activities, only to turn around and be like, oh, nope, not what's going on.
Welcome to the Cybersecurity Defenders Podcast, weekly Intel chat. My name is Christopher Luft. I'm one of the co-founders of Lima Charlie, and I will be your host. Joining me today to break down the cybersecurity news being shared by the awesome InfoSec community is the one and only Matt Bromley. And don't forget, this podcast is brought to you by Lima Charlie, maker of the SecOps Cloud Platform, infrastructure for security operations. Think of it as a backend for your MSSP, where everything is built API first. Scale with ease and confidence as your business grows. You can start today for free at limacharlie.io. Now let's get into it.
How you doing, Matt Bromley?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing well. How are you today, sir?
I'm pretty good. Lots of chaos dawned on me today that we're moving in 8 days, and I'm looking around my house and there's stuff everywhere. So we'll get there, but I think it's going to be a bit of a big push. And I know we're both kind of short on time. So do you want to just get into the things?
Well, let's get right into it. I'll tell you one thing, though, and I will just empathize with you a little bit. Nothing reminds you how short life is, like kids do. They grow up way fast. And nothing tells you how much stuff you actually own until you have to. I feel that one for sure. I'm with you on that. So yeah, but let's get into it. We need to talk all day about Chris's belongings. We'd be here for all day.
All right. I like these first two as a bit of an update on what we've been talking about a lot recently. No surprises here, but I feel like it's so easy to get desensitized to things because of the news cycle. The US and Iran are still in conflict, and this is still having knock-on effects in the cyber world. In particular, the cyber threat environment in the Middle East has intensified sharply following military operations involving Israel, the United States, and Iran. According to the UAE Cybersecurity Council, daily breach attempts targeting the United Arab Emirates increased from roughly 90 to 200,000 per day in early February to between 600 and 800,000 per day after the conflict escalated. Cybersecurity firm CipherLeak also observed major increases in cyber-relevant activity across Gulf states, with the UAE reaching 15 times normal activity levels, Saudi Arabia 25 times, and Qatar more than quadrupling. Researchers said the nature of attacks has shifted from mostly hacktivist denial-of-service campaigns and Telegram claims to more credible intrusion and compromise attempts. CipherLeak CEO Mohamed Amin Belarbi described the conflict as creating a mobilization effect among hacktivists, opportunistic cyber criminals, and Iran-aligned actors. Analysts also highlighted the growing role of cyber operations in the conflict itself, including reports that both Iran and Israel use compromised IP cameras for intelligence gathering and assessing missile strike impacts. Critical infrastructure remains a key concern, although researchers said Gulf nations have improved their defensive capabilities. CipherLeak found little evidence of successful destructive attacks against UAE infrastructure, but noted increased targeting of sectors such as finance, telecommunications, aviation, law enforcement, and energy-adjacent systems. Belarbi said a serious attack would likely involve disruptions to identity systems, payment processing, logistics, telecom routing, or government cloud services rather than simple website defacements. Analysts added that improved monitoring and detection capabilities in countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia may partly explain the increase in observed attacks while reducing their operational impact. The article also examined the role of artificial intelligence in the regional threat landscape. Researchers said AI currently gives attackers a scaling advantage more than a sophistication advantage, allowing lower-skilled operators to automate phishing campaigns, probing activity, and fake breach claims at larger scale. ESET analysts noted that many AI-enabled attacks remain poorly executed, but the increased volume still creates pressure on defenders. The report concluded by emphasizing that traditional security practices remain essential, especially patch management and securing internet-facing systems as a regional threat actor continues to aggressively exploit exposed vulnerabilities. So just near the end there, I really had a moment where, you know, we've talked about this before, where AI is not necessarily making attacks more sophisticated, but we're just seeing like the breadth of them, like the volume of them increasing, and hearing it backing up the defensive teams. I almost wonder if there's a term coming that's sort of around the idea of a DDoS attack, but one that just jams up the defensive team with tickets they need to investigate.
Chris, most defensive teams are already there. That's we just call that a Wednesday, sir. That's there's no term needed. That's just a day that ends in Y.
Yeah.
It's almost like they've listened to this podcast. I really like the idea that someone's like, you know what? It's not sophistication, it's scale. And yeah. I'm just like, huh, yeah. I wonder where I've heard that before. Maybe in my headphones, who knows? But I'm not being a little bit facetious here. I agree with pretty much everything in here. This feels to me like more of a reflection of what we're seeing. It is shaking up the region, if you will. It's shaking up the entire region. We've seen we've seen nations leave OPEC, or at least one nation left OPEC. We're seeing heavy quantities in different areas and whatnot. And Chris, I think part of it is probably related to like ability to fight back, geographical preference, actual ties, and all sorts of stuff. There's probably a lot of this that's way above our knowledge of Middle East history. Right. I don't think I'm sure a large majority of it is probably affiliation and ability to work with the U.S. and whatnot. But I think part of it is also like, you know, historical insight, cyber defense abilities, cyber retaliation abilities. And is it kind of like picking on the smaller kid at the playground, knowing they can't do much back while the bully is left alone and stuff like that? And I say that, you know, not diminishing all the other kinetic activity that's happening and whatnot, but I'm kind of not surprised when I first read and saw about this, is that, you know, there are some nations that are being kind of targeted heavily in retaliation. Chris, we saw this on the kinetic front at the very beginning. I think it was actually multiple sites in the UAE that were, you know, targeted as a result of the initial kinetic actions. I think there was a hotel in Dubai, if I'm not mistaken. There was AWS data centers that was in this area, or in this you know, nation or combination of nations, if you will. So I don't view this as much of a surprise, maybe more of a follow-on. Mm-hmm. But the actual like why behind the scenes is probably not just affiliation and regional alliances and stuff like that. It's probably also focused on their ability to bounce back.
Yeah, I was actually just speaking with Dr. Adil Sheikh Mohammed, who's going to be on the next episode of the podcast, interview style. And he's in Dubai, and he was saying it's been like really intense there recently. And he's hoping that some of the actions they're taking will sort of create the feeling of comfort and security versus right now, which feels very uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I'm with you. I think we're going to continue to see stuff like this kind of progress as the conflict continues. I mean, there's a lot of unhappy folks when it comes to alliance. I'm not diminishing the kinetic damage that's happening, but kind of geopolitically, there's a lot of shakeup that's happening here. It's maybe testing some already fragile alliances, but I'm not an expert on the region. If anyone here listening is, please let Chris know. He'd love to interview you, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a definitely complicated part of the world, and I have no real education that way. This next one, same region, a little more focused, an intrusion campaign attributed with moderate confidence to the Iranian state-linked group Muddy Water was disguised as a chaos ransomware attack, according to research from Rapid7. The attackers relied heavily on social engineering techniques rather than traditional ransomware deployment. In the observed incident, attackers contacted employees through Microsoft Teams and initiated screen sharing sessions to gain access to victim systems. During those sessions, the threat actors collected credentials, manipulated multi-factor authentication protections, and in some cases deployed remote management tools such as AnyDesk to maintain access. Rapid7 said the attackers conducted activity more commonly associated with espionage operations and financially motivated ransomware attacks. After establishing access, the group performed reconnaissance, gathered VPN configuration information, harvested credentials, and moved laterally throughout the environment using RDP sessions and the DW Agent remote access tool. The attackers also deployed a custom remote access Trojan called Dark Comp, which supports command execution, file manipulation, and persistent shell access. Researchers noted that the malware was signed with a certificate previously associated with Muddy Water operations and communicated with infrastructure linked to the group. The operation eventually shifted into an extortion phase. Victims received emails claiming sensitive information had been stolen and threatening public disclosure unless a ransom was paid. The organization was subsequently listed on the Chaos Ransomware leak site, and victims were instructed to locate credentials for a secure negotiation chat. However, Rapid7 found no evidence that file encrypting ransomware had ever been deployed in the victim environment. Researchers believe the Chaos Ransomware branding was intentionally used as a false flag to obscure the state-sponsored nature of the operation and delay investigators from identifying persistent mechanisms left behind by the attackers. Rapid7 concluded that the technical indicators, malware infrastructure, and operational tactics were all consistent with previous Muddy Water activity. This group also tracked as Mango Sandstorm, Mercury, Seedworm, and Static Kitten has previously been linked by the U.S. to the government of Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security researchers. Security researchers said the use of ransomware-themed extortion appears designed to complicate attribution while maintaining the group's broader espionage activity. So this one feels more pointed. Yeah. I don't know what the outcome is here other than to sow chaos, but pun intended, right?
Chris, this is where we get a brand new term, intrusion masquerading. That's something you don't see. Us old folks would call that a red herring, but intrusion masquerading here. Imagine this, like dropping all the breadcrumbs to pretend that you've launched a ransomware attack and just spin up all the resources and all the things and all sorts of crazy activities, only to turn around and be like, oh, nope, not what's going on. In any event, I found this to be a little interesting of like, wow, is following all these breadcrumbs and all these trails, but then actually figuring out that, no, this was some nation state activity that was taking place and, getting into custom rats, any desk being deployed, maintaining persistence in the environment and whatnot, just seems to me like a great way to send the security team running down a path over there while you're doing some secret stuff over here. Or something. And, you know, getting in, stealing different credentials, manipulating MFA, getting in place there, moving laterally throughout the environment and whatnot. And then, interestingly enough, like exfiltrating information and then launching a subsequent, like, hey, we've exfiltrated stuff, pay the ransom. And I'm like, what else do you think they were doing during that time? Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting part is, again, if I send the whole team off and to the right, what is it that's actually going on to the left and whatnot? And now you've got a team now. Chris, one of the things that I get to teach I cover in the classes that I teach is this idea of, you know, there are certain types of incidents that kick off all sorts of processes and notifications, and a ransomware notification is one that always tends to kick off the most critical of process paths. I mean, that's media, that's comms. Right. Public notifications. That's
red alert. Red alert.
Yeah, it's as high as it gets, right? And I find it interesting from an adversarial perspective that you wouldn't try to lessen the masquerading, but actually increasing the masquerading. And I kind of look at it as like, hey, I'm going to go steal a stick of gum over there, so I'm going to drop a bomb over here. And it's like, wow, that's a massive overkill for what's going on. But can you think of a better way, and I don't mean to give the adversary credit here, but can you think of a better way to mobilize all the resources in the wrong direction?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or, dare I say, and again, I'm no adversary here, but hey, if I wanted to test and see what a target or victim organization's incident response plan actually looked like, I mean, why not get them to do it, right? Pull the fire alarm, sit back, watch and see what happens, and then all of a sudden you're the wiser as to, all right, they're not actually going to catch us when we do the real thing.
Right. That's, yeah, it's interesting, especially at that level. It's hard to know what the motivation is. When it's financial, it's a straight line. But when we're talking nation states, especially in a conflict region, it's anybody's guess what's really going on.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. This one is one you're going to want to pay attention to if you're using Palo Alto's PAN-OS. Palo Alto Networks was warned customers that a critical remote code execution vulnerability in PAN-OS is being actively exploited in the wild. The flaw tracked as CVE-2026-0300 affects the user ID authentication portal, also known as a captive portal service. According to the company, the vulnerability is a buffer overflow that allows unauthenticated attackers to execute arbitrary code with root privileges. Yikes! On affected PA series. Yeah, that's not what you want to hear. It's affected PA series and VM series firewalls by sending specially crafted packets. The vulnerability carries a CVSS score of 9.3 when the user ID authentication portal is exposed to the internet or untrusted networks. If access to the portal is restricted to trusted internal IP addresses, the severity rating drops to an 8.7. Palo Alto Networks said the exploitation activity currently appears limited and specifically targets deployments where the portal is publicly accessible. The company emphasized that organizations following standard security practices, such as limiting access to trusted internal networks, face significantly lower risk. Multiple PAN-OS versions are affected, including releases in the 12.1, 11.2, 11.1, and 10.2 branches. Palo Alto Networks stated that fixes are scheduled to begin rolling out on May 13, 2026, but at the time of publication, no patches were yet available. The company also clarified that only firewalls configured to use the user ID authentication portal are vulnerable to exploitation. Until patches become available, Palo Alto Networks recommends restricting user ID authentication portal access to trusted zones or disabling the feature entirely if it is not required. The advisory highlights a continued focus by attackers on perimeter security and internet-facing authentication services, particularly where exposed management or access portals remain publicly reachable. Yeah, man, the edge, it's still a thing. I know the perimeter isn't what it once was, but edge devices most certainly are. There's not a lot of EDR or monitoring that goes on those things, and I think they're a place that's a good target for folks.
Patch. patch all the things. This shouldn't come as a surprise.
But there's no patch, Matt.
Go patch.
There's a patch.
What's that?
It's 6 days until there's going to be a patch. So what do you do now?
You get ready to patch. You posture patch. You get everything lined up. You test. You harden. You increase log visibility. You turn everything up to 11, and then you get ready to patch. Because if you are again facing this, now this is one thing that I find kind of interesting, Chris. Looking at this article here, in this company, it has a CVSS score of 9.3. The severity comes down to 8.7 if access to the portal is restricted to only trusted IP or internal IP addresses, as you mentioned. But this is one of those situations where it's kind of like, no matter what, you need to be patched. You need to be ready for this thing. Like, this is not, I think, the type of clearance that you can just rest on. Like, oh, we have it limited. Don't worry about it. Right. And that up. It can still be exploited. Users or adversaries can still be on the inside. So, like, posture to patch. And I don't know, Chris, I look at this as actually a blessing, because if you are an organization out there who has these devices, you have a few days to patch. And hey, plan, prepare. That's that capability to say, oh, wait, we know this is coming down the line. Let's get ready for it.
Yeah. All right. Last one we got today. Again, we're in a hurry, so we're burning through them. Attackers are using Microsoft's Phone Link application in a campaign that Cisco Talos says has been active since January. The attacks target Windows PCs that are already paired with smartphones through Phone Link, which is a pre-installed on Windows 10 and 11 system. Rather than infecting the mobile device directly, the attackers compromise a PC and leverage a trusted synchronization relationship between the computer and the phone to monitor and potentially steal SMS messages and one-time passwords used for two-factor authentication. The campaign uses the CloudZ remote access Trojan together with a newly identified plugin called Fino. Cisco Talos researchers said the attack chain begins with an unknown initial access vector, followed by the execution of a fake screen connect update executable that launches a .NET loader, which installs CloudZ on the victim system. CloudZ establishes encrypted communications with a command and control server and provides capabilities including credential theft, screen recording, shell command execution, file management, and plugin deployment. The malware then deploys the Fino plugin, which specifically looks for active phone link processes such as your phone and phone experience host. Fino performs reconnaissance to determine whether a smartphone is actively synchronized with the infected Windows machine. If an active relay session is detected, the malware flags the host as maybe connected, indicating the attackers may be able to monitor SMS traffic and authentication messages. According to Cisco Talos, the malware can potentially access Phone Link's SQLite database files stored on the PC that would allow attackers to intercept SMS-based one-time passwords and authenticator application notifications without placing malware on the smartphone itself. Researchers noted that this approach is unusual because the attackers are exploiting the desktop-side synchronization channel rather than directly compromising the mobile device. Cisco Talos said there is currently no confirmed evidence that data has been successfully exfiltrated, but the infrastructure associated with the campaign remains active, suggesting the operation is ongoing. The report also highlights broader concerns around the reliability of SMS-based multi-factor authentication. The researchers recommend organizations move away from OTP and SMS-based secondary authentication methods where possible. They also suggest disabling PhoneLink in environments where it is not necessary. for detection and mitigation. Defenders are advised to monitor for suspicious regasm.exe executions, unauthorized scheduled tasks, and known command and control infrastructure tied to the malware. Cisco Talos additionally published indicators of compromise, Clam AV signatures, and snort rules to help organizations identify and block the threat. So, it's interesting because I know phones, just the way they're architected, tend to be very isolated in the way processes run, and they make them fairly secure platforms. But these guys are, exploiting the synchronization mechanism on the Windows desktop, which we all know has problems.
Yeah. I mean, so Chris, the funny thing is when I first saw this article and I knew we were going to cover it, I actually first thought like my Windows phone, remember Windows phone? I first thought it was Windows phone. And I was like, there's like four people in the world who are vulnerable here. Like, I feel bad for you. But actually, I think it ties into a much larger victim base or potential victim. Yeah. Here it is, the phone link, a thing that allows you to sync text messages, notifications, and calls between mobile devices and PCs. I'd imagine there's quite a few folks utilizing this,
and especially enterprise kind of people, right?
I am almost sure of it. And interestingly enough, there's a really interesting plugin here, as Chris mentioned, that kind of takes advantage of that. And I feel like this is kind of a classic example for folks out there who maybe haven't been in cybersecurity that long or haven't been in the defenders side of the world that long. This idea of connecting two kind of inherently different devices to each other has always created a gap where adversaries like to exist, and they thrive, actually, because you likely have to introduce a protocol somewhere that translates in between these two things. I know to a lot of us, it just feels like device, you know, Matt, what are you talking about? But as Chris mentioned, the way that mobile phones are architected versus the way that a desktop operating system is architected, you know, laptop or desktop, it doesn't matter, a thick client, if you will, they're inherently different in the way they're put together. This is no dig at Microsoft, but Apple has actually made like enormous strides over the past, Chris, I don't know, 10, 15 years to try to standardize what is the operating system fluidity between devices. It's not easy. It's not easy to do. And in this case, you've got an adversary who figures out like, hey, I've actually found a way in this protocol connection, in the connectivity between these two different types of devices, there's inherently going to be some code flaws, some weaknesses and things like that. And adversaries are using it to their advantage. Hat tip to the folks who pulled this article together, Elizabeth Montalbano over at Dark Green. There's actually a lot of really cool references in here. There's a report from Talos. There's actually a tie back as well to Proofpoint. And Chris, I'll ask you to put both links into the show notes for everyone. But seeing that they're actually utilizing this to steal OTP messages. So if in case anyone's like, oh no, what can the adversary do with all this kind of stuff? It's MFA bypassing. It's walking out. And this is why a lot of organizations these days are moving away from pin pushes, if you will, and more towards like verification, very specific kind of app usage. I've got one verifier. I've got an Okta verifier, Chris. I've actually got to open the app and type in a number, which is given to me on the screen, right? And unless you can physically unlock all of these things together, you're not going to be able to get to that particular number.
Yeah.
It's a push towards more advanced authentication, but I know for quite a few organizations out there, you probably have had MFA for like a year. And now it's like, oh man, another thing we got to deal with. So that's where I think the adversaries are finding a lot of success is they're like, hey, we know a lot of folks are still using like SMS OTPs and things like that. Let's get in and actually, find ways to steal these, and then we can bypass MFA. And that's what they're doing.
And I think that's such an interesting thing you just pointed on there too. We all know what the best practices are. We all understand the risks, so we will take the work to do the new thing and make sure we're secure. But a lot of people who are just showing up at work who have access to these big enterprise systems, they just want to do their job and they don't understand the risk. And so asking them to install a new app or take a new protocol, like that's a big challenge. And I hear that a lot from folks that, like when I ask, like, what's the hardest part of your job working in the SOC or, you know, managing security for this company? And I always expect it to be something technical, but oftentimes it's that which comes back over the fence to me is just like getting people to, pardon my language, but give a shit and do the thing that's going to keep the organization safe. So I don't know what the solution is there, but I understand your pain.
Yeah. And it's also a combination of like how much restrictive behavior do we put on or how much behavior restrictions do we put into place? Like if you've got an organization where folks have utilized, you know, phone, like they don't know it, but they connected their phone to their laptop or their desktop, and it's just part of how they do their job. And then you impart this behavior and someone's like, well, I've got my entire workflow built around this thing. I mean, Chris, this is for a lot of people out there, this is the type of ecosystem stickiness that we talk about. Like it is part of their workflow. It is part of their daily life to have all these things in one screen and one dashboard. And you take part of that away, it's like, no, I'm going to do it anyways.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks know that. And it's tough. It's a tough trade-off to also try and enforce the security here. And adversaries know this. Yeah. They know it's going to be hard for you as a defender to disable this capability or feature set. You can't just say no, right?
Yeah.
And that's where they thrive. So for defenders out there, trust me, Chris and I feel your pain. We're talking about it somewhat vicariously here. But you know, good security practices and user education can also be a really useful way to limit impact here.
Yeah. Awesome. Matt, we did it under 30 minutes.
we both got to get back to life now. But Chris, I appreciate every time we record this every week, we get a chance to step away and just talk about some fun, cool stuff. So thank you for always having me on here to do these with you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I think the next week we'll also be running from the kitchen table. But the week after, I should be in my new office space, which I'm really excited about. It's a big room. I'm going to get to set up all the lighting, get her all pretty. So yeah, I look forward to seeing what the next 12 months of this look like.
To all of our listeners, I just want to throw out there really quick. Chris has given us verbally a 2-week time frame to be set up and operational. Chris, I'm not going to hold you to it, but in 2 weeks, I will be like, so where's that lighting at, buddy?
All right, challenge accepted, sir.
Awesome. All right, Chris. Always a pleasure when I see you, man.
Take care.
Take care.
And that brings us to the end of another Intel Chat. You can support this show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend or subscribing and giving us a rating or leaving a comment on your chosen podcast platform. If you want to be part of the conversation and access the intel we talk about in real time, you can join our community forum at community.limacharlie.io. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you on the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.